God calls, He also equips. So I am equipped for said skills. So there you go. Welcome again. You know, since I've been here about 4 years, and since so many of you are new here, you probably don't know much about me. So I thought I'd kind of give you a better perspective. You know, there's an old saying that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So to kind of start things off, when I was a 20-year-old college student at Princeton, my girlfriend, now my wife, Yvette, and I had an unplanned pregnancy, still trying to figure out how that happened. But I digress. And when she went to student services, the nurse came back with the pregnancy test and sort of said in a matter-of-fact tone that the test was positive. And then she said, also in a matter-of-fact tone, well, now, of course, you're going to have an abortion. And so Yvette said, well, you know, no, I don't want to have an abortion. I want to have a baby. I want to get married. And she says, well, what year are you? And Yvette says, well, I'm a sophomore. And she says, oh, my gosh, how are you going to graduate from Princeton with a baby? And Yvette says, no, I want to keep my baby. And she says, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, how are you going to graduate from Princeton? And what do you want to do, you know, when you graduate? And Yvette says, well, I want to become a doctor. And she says, oh, my gosh, you know, become a doctor? Graduate from Princeton with a baby? And she says, no, I want to keep my baby. Well, we also learned as undergraduates that although Princeton would not pay for the delivery of the baby, they would pay for the abortion. So there we were, nearly penniless college students. And I remember her coming back to the dorm and us sitting on the edge of the bed, which is obviously where we should have spent more time. Let that settle in. I just keep it real. It's funny now. It wasn't funny then. But she was a bit shell-shocked. I mean, the nurse really didn't offer much support. I mean, she was an older woman, probably a mother herself. She could have said, you know, let's see what we can do to make your choice work. Or she could have said, you know, who's the father? Where's the father? Maybe we can have him come back to the next visit to make sure that he's prepared to support your choice and his child. And she didn't. Some choice. So there we were on the edge of the bed, and she told me what happened. And interestingly, I basically said to her, you know, basically we're going forward with the plan that we're going to get married, and I'm going to be a husband to you, and I'm going to be a father to our child growing inside of you. And that's exactly what we did. There's our wedding picture right there. Yeah, I don't know where I'm looking. You know, I was 20. You know, you're 20, and sometimes you just look. You guys who have 20-year-olds, you know that. They'll just be looking places. Anyway, so there we were. So we got married. And, you know, it's interesting. It's been 34 years. And you see, well, thank you, Bob Kraft. And the interesting thing is, you know, we had an unplanned pregnancy, but we didn't have a crisis pregnancy because we created a family. And the nurse was right about one thing. Yvette didn't graduate with one child. She actually graduated with two. There are our two boys, Jamin and Justin. Jamin still dresses like that, but he's a hipster, so it's kind of what he does. That's the older one there. And here's Yvette walking in graduation. She's carrying Justin. There you go. Yeah, just beautiful moment. And you know, it's funny, that picture, there was an AP photographer there that was at the graduation and took this picture of this Princeton undergraduate walking with a baby strapped to her. We weren't trying to make history. She had the ability to breastfeed. I did not. And it was really what it was all about. And it's how God sort of used that. Here's Yvette graduating from medical school. There she is getting her degree. Yay. And there's Yvette as a doctor delivering the first baby that she delivered as a doctor. There she goes. Yeah. And there are Jamin and Justin out of diapers, both married. The circle of life, right? Here's the thing for me. You know, it reminds me of that old saying that anybody can count the number of seeds in a single apple, but only God knows the number of apples in a single seed. See, we don't know about potential. You know, we can't control that kind of stuff, and we shouldn't be trying to determine who should live and who should not, based on the situation that we see, because we see but dimly, right? Well, you know, some time ago, I was thinking about this, and God gave me an insight about the best known unplanned pregnancy. And even though I was obviously involved in one, it really wasn't the best known one to me. Actually, the one that came to my mind was actually the birth of Christ. You see, from Mary's perspective, her pregnancy was unplanned. She had hopes and dreams and aspirations for her life that did not include a baby at this time and in this way. And I know the kind of feeling she had was the same kind of feeling that Yvette had in the nurse's office or any woman that goes to a pregnancy center or even an abortion clinic. Hopes and dreams and aspirations. But we know the story of Mary. Mary said, "Let it be unto me as you have said." And she chose life. And you know, here's the thing. What did God do to make sure that Mary's unplanned pregnancy didn't become a crisis pregnancy? What did he do? He sent an angel to Joseph. You see, Joseph, as a man, faced a similar dilemma as any abortion-minded man. He had hopes and dreams and aspirations for his life and for his life with Mary that did not include a child at this time and in this way. And since he couldn't put the baby away, he was going to put the woman and the baby away. But God called to him, sent an angel, and told him to be a husband to Mary and a father to the child growing inside of her. And Joseph chose life, too. And, you know, when Herod wanted to kill Jesus and just destroy their lives, who did the angel go to? Did the angel go to Mary? No, the angel went to Joseph. Went to Joseph and said, "You have to provide and you have to protect." You see, there's always been a role for men in God's design when it comes to unplanned pregnancies. Even in the birth of Christ. You see, because the Holy Family was holy family. Was holy family. Why? Because God just doesn't want children to have life. He wants them to have abundant life. But you have to ask the question, what does abundant life look like to a baby? You see, a doctor can give a baby life, can deliver a baby, and can deliver that baby and leave it on a cold steel table, that little beating heart. You all know the story well of the abortion doctor. Kermit Gosnell. He gave children life, but then he killed the little ones. That's not abundant life. Or the doctor can hand the baby to a single mom. And we know that that's a life-affirming act. No question about that. But you got to ask yourself a question. Is that really God's design? Is that really God's best? Is that really God's desire for her and for her child? See, I grew up in a single mother home. I know well the challenges that mothers and children face. Or that doctor can deliver that baby and hand it to a father and mother who love each other, love their child, and ideally are united in a godly marriage. Now, that's abundant life. And how do we know that? Well, because that's what happened with Jesus. You see, Jesus could have come into the world. He could have been born via a single mother. The scripture says he was going to be born of a virgin, but it didn't say a married virgin. But see, this would have accomplished God's purpose, but it would have violated a principle, a design, a high idea for how children should come into the world. Jesus was given abundant life, and he became abundant life for us all. So you see, you know, from my perspective, we really shouldn't just be pro-life people. We need to be pro-abundant life people. But we can't be pro-abundant life people without engaging fathers and talking about marriage. And I always tell people, this isn't just about whether the mother marries the father of her child. We know the data shows that, you know, it's best when that happens, whenever that's possible. It's a high idea. But you see, it's all about a transformation that needs to take place. See, when she comes to the pregnancy center, things have been delinked in her mind. What's been delinked is fatherhood, motherhood, sex, and marriage. And if that stuff is delinked when she walks out the door, she'll be a repeat client. See, then our work becomes transactional, not transformational. See, our sign shouldn't say, "Thank you, come again." Our sign should say, "Thank you, don't come again." Not to be served, but to be service to others. Now, as you think about this, and I've talked a lot about this over the years, and certainly those who've heard me talk at pregnancy center banquets, you know, why haven't we been as aggressive in terms of articulating what I just articulated? Why have we linked those things together? And for me, I just want to go back and do maybe a little history lesson. Maybe it's my perspective. But I think part of this has to do with how the issue was framed in 1973 when the abortion issue came into the public square. You know, in many ways, sort of the pro-choice people were able to frame the argument. And they said, basically, this is about a woman and about a question mark. And then they started to define the question mark. First, it was the product of conception. Then it's choice. And now it's complicated. But it's always about the woman and something that's not human. And then we responded. We responded in large measure saying, no, this is about the baby. It's about the baby. And then we started getting attacked by the other side. Said, you don't care about women, you just care about babies. And then we responded and said, no. Love them both. Love them both. Love them both. Now, I believe that this is the wrong paradigm and that we need to have a paradigm shift. You know, I had a reporter ask me early on, said, you know, is CareNet more for the woman or more for the baby? And I said, that's a great question. That's like asking, am I more for breathing in or for breathing out? I mean, they're both essential to life. They're both essential to life. I said, you know, I think we should reject this entire paradigm and reframe the conversation, in my view, to anchor it right back to Scripture in a very powerful way. See, I believe that we shouldn't just reject abortion for one reason, but for two. You see, I think that we should reject abortion not just because it's an assault on the sanctity of life, but also it's an assault on the sanctity of marriage and family as God designed. See, when abortion was legalized, two things happened and only one really got talked about, which was abortion. But there was something else that happened. You see, we delinked fatherhood and motherhood in the womb, which means we delinked wifehood and husbandhood in the womb. Because in God's economy, you're not a wife and you're not a mother unless you're a wife, and you're not a father unless you're a husband. So those things were delinked in the womb. And so legally, men become fathers at birth, and legally, mothers become mothers at conception. Now, I don't have the time to kind of go through what that impact has had, but we are feeling it all through culture. All through our culture. See, our God is a God of unity, and He united fatherhood and motherhood together in the womb. And the baby is a living reflection of this. And what God has joined together, no man, no government, no nobody should put asunder. Moreover, fatherhood is a much more fragile cultural and social institution than motherhood. And now it's been stripped from its historic and God-given connection in the womb, and the effects have been profound. Now, I imagine some of you are mothers in here. Are you willing to claim your kids? Keep your hands up. Now, how many of you as mothers were there to the end of the delivery? Now, if I ask fathers all over the world that question, you get where I'm driving with this. See, fatherhood is a much more fragile social construct. And it takes society in a much more powerful way to link fathers to their kids. And God did us forth at conception, and the law delinked all that. You see, we should object to abortion because we believe that children should have mothers and fathers from the point of conception on. And should have framed the argument consistently that way from the very beginning and continue to articulate that message, which means that we should be working just as hard to build strong married families as we are to save babies. And that means that we should be calling to every guy to be a Joseph. See, we ask those women to tap into that proverbial Mary inside of her, don't we? So we want to ascribe the virtue of Mary to her. Well, we should challenge and ascribe the character of Joseph to the guy. And that's the only way we're going to get to kind of where we need to be in terms of talking about family. And the other thing from my standpoint is that we may want to make sure that we don't fall into a trap, and it's a well-placed one, when we kind of frame this issue as solely a woman's issue. And there's the mantra out there in the public square that says her body, it's her choice. And we have to make sure we don't fall into this trap and frame it that way when we kind of articulate, well, it's all about the woman. Because, you know, when you think about it, when we say it that way, we actually are agreeing with the pro-choice side. And what we're arguing about is whether the baby is a question mark or not. And both of these models, both of these paradigms actually exclude fathers. And if they exclude fathers, they're going to exclude any kind of discussion of marriage or anything like that. And the question is, well, who needs men anyway? I mean, the other side, if they prevail, there's no baby. And if we need the guy, we need him just to pay for the abortion. And now that we've built abortion into health care, we don't even need him for that. Why do you think that Planned Parenthood has been so supportive of that model? But if we prevail, there's going to be a baby. And at a minimum, we want the guy to pay for the baby. And certainly from a societal and Christian perspective, we want much more. We know children need more than that. So we don't even get into that kind of conversation. So we actually benefit the other side when we frame the argument in a way that's consistent with the paradigm that they set up. You know, Frederica Matthews Green, some of you have probably read her stuff. I love her. She had this book she wrote, Real Choices, Listening to Women Looking for Alternatives to Abortion. And here's what she said. Providing a substitute for the father in pregnancy and child rearing is like providing a substitute hand. A dexterous, lightweight prosthesis with some grasping ability is better than nothing, better than a hook, better than last year's model. But the most advanced artificial hand that researchers can dream up will always be blunt and clumsy compared to the flexibility, warmth, and sensitivity of the original. It's better not to lose the hand. It's better not to lose the man. So we have to make sure that we never allow ourselves to be put into the trap that we try to become artificial fathers and artificial husbands in terms of the work that we do, because they need real ones. And the other issue here is that, you know, when you talk to women about abortion and who do they talk to and who influences them, you know, we did some research last year where we talked to women who had had abortions and we asked them who was the most influential in your decision, right? Who was talking to, who you're talking to? And far and away, it's the father. More than the abortion provider, more than her girlfriend, her best friend, her anybody, far and away the father. And then we asked them who was the most influential in your decision to abort, and guess who it was? Once again, the father. So think about the work that we do. How's our business model? Is it designed to actually get the most influential person involved? Or are we trying to get the least influential people involved? I'm a business guy. If you told me, listen, before I do business with you, Joe over there in the corner is the guy who I talk to, and Joe is the most influential, I can tell you, I'm going to be trying to see how I can get to Joe. Is that what we're doing? I mean, I do everything possible to get you to introduce me to Joe. Let me frame this another way. You know, some of you have seen this chart. I'll use it again this year. But it really talks about the support needed by mothers and children. And down the one side, it says physical, emotional, spiritual, and social. If you think about how Jesus engaged the woman at the well, he connected with her physically, socially, spiritually, emotionally, right? And it just shows that over time, the support needed by mothers and children increases over time. And God is wise. He built in a model to make sure that mothers and children get the support that they need. It's called husbands and fathers. That's God's design. Now, here's the work that we do. See that little teal in the corner there? Amazing, amazing, amazing work, right? From conception to birth and maybe a little further on. And some of the work is really trying to move further to the right. Now, here's the thing, right? Amazing work, but here's the challenge. See that blue is missing support. See, to the degree that a woman can't figure out how she's going to fill in the rest of that blue, she's much more likely to have abortion. And that's the reason why the data shows that 86% of the women that have abortions are unmarried. So if we're delinking the issue in our work, we're doing it, she's not. It's absolutely tied to that. Absolutely tied to that. Missing support. Missing support. And, you know, we're also going to have to think differently about the church and the way that the church is engaged in this work for a number of different reasons. First and foremost, when you look at the research, 54% of the women who have abortions profess to be either Catholic or Protestant. Now, if you do the math, a million abortions, that's 540,000 abortions where someone that knew enough to check on a form that they were Catholic or Protestant. Cut it in half again. Let's just say it's 200,000. Average abortion is $500. Follow my math. 500 times 200,000, that's $110 million that Christians are funding the abortion industry. We're trying to overturn Roe v. Wade and defund Planned Parenthood and yada yada. We need to overturn Roe v. Wade in our own churches and in our own pews and in our own hearts. See, that's the low-hanging fruit right there, that woman at the back of the church. And the other thing that we know from the research is that when we talk to Christian women who had had abortions, 4 out of 10 of these women were in church, attending church at the time that they had their abortion. 4 out of 10. In the church on Sunday, in the abortion clinic on Monday. And before, lest we be too critical of these women, we have to acknowledge something, that there really has not been an on-ramp. If you wake up Sunday morning and you get that blue plus and it's not good news, who exactly in the church are you supposed to talk to? Who are you supposed to talk to? And we know it's like 9 days from the time that she confirms her pregnancy to the time she sets that appointment for the abortion. All of a sudden, Planned Parenthood is looking like a compassion alternative. And we also know from our research that the women say that they are afraid that they'll be treated like the Pharisees wanted to treat the woman caught in adultery. Stone her with condemnation. Not the way Jesus wanted to treat her. See, but you can't stone the woman without stoning the baby. You know, there's a third reason, which is really important, and it really is connected to you. You know, the pregnancy center movement has had a very difficult time. We've had a difficult time planning pregnancy centers in urban communities. It's been a challenge for a long, long time where the abortion rates are disproportionately high. And this graphic here kind of shows just L.A. And what we did was we mapped the abortion, the Planned Parenthoods in L.A., and what we found was that they were just sort of clustered around the urban area. And then we mapped the pregnancy centers, and what we found was there were some there, but most of them were sort of spread around the suburbs. And then we had this idea, why don't we just map churches? One denomination of churches, and we did that. And what you can see is that all around those abortion clinics were churches. You know, there's a final reason, and it really is tied to, you know, the travels that I've done in this work. As I travel the country and I talk to pregnancy centers, I've been stunned and troubled by the response to one question. You know, I talk to centers and I say, we've got, you know, solid support, financial support from churches and material support and even volunteers. However, when I ask the question, in your support network, how many churches do you have that you could hand a client to the church for ongoing discipleship? It's generally very, very true. And here's the thing. You know, God calls us to the Great Commission, right? And what is that? We're supposed to make disciples for Jesus Christ. We're supposed to be disciples for life who make disciples for life. Now, we've been doing a fantastic job with evangelism. Just looking at the data from last year, 140,000 evangelical presentations. Just amazing, amazing work. But the thing is, see, evangelism leads to conversion, which is wonderful. But if we just convert this person and we send them back to the same community, see, everybody is a disciple of something in somebody or some worldview. It's just a matter of where. So if she came to your center and he came to your center because he was a disciple of the culture, right, which is delinked to all those things, if you convert him and then send him back to the same discipleship model, what should you expect? Well, you should expect what discipleship does. Replication. Repeat clients. And that's the reason why we have to move those folks from the center to the church. For discipleship and replication from that way. See, God has a design. And we want to have them in an environment where someone can walk along with them long term. But if you connect her to a community of faith where discipleship is happening and God's design is there, what are you going to see? You're going to see what? Transformation with her, transformation with the guy who got her pregnant, and transformation with her child. So we've been praying about all this stuff and what we're supposed to do with the plan that God laid out for us or the challenges. And we kind of came up with a new strategy. I want to just have you check it out.
To the issue of abortion, it has become America's Holocaust.
Since the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, at least 1 million unborn children every year have lost their lives to abortion, and countless women and men have had to suffer from the negative consequences of abortion.
Abortion provides temporary relief, but afterwards comes the bigger package of depression and guilt and shame and sorrow and regret that you live with for many, many years.
I come from a generation where at least a third of my generation isn't here because of abortion. And for me, that's just unconscionable. And I can't live in a society where millions upon millions of my fellow American citizens are not here.
We did a lot of research. And, you know, one of the things that we discovered is that there are women in the church having abortions. Our research found that 4 out of every 10 women who has had an abortion was actively going to church at the time of her abortion.
And the reality is that when it comes to the abortion issue and the life issue, the church has not really been using that transformative power that it has around this issue. It's been an issue that's been outside of the church when the problem is inside the church and the church has a call to the broader culture. So we're inspired around this project specifically to do that. A tool that will help mobilize the church.
Most pastors I know are concerned about the well-being of people in their church as well as outside of their church. Well, we need to be as equally concerned about the life in the womb. And so because it's an issue of life, and God is the author of life, that we must be in life-related issues. For us, it's a priority, and I think it should be a priority for any pastor who's concerned about comprehensive ministry.
As a Christian, our hope should be Christ's hope. And the last thing that he said was what? Go and make disciples of all nations. And certainly God has really given us an opportunity, a unique opportunity in this day and age in our culture for this life issue to be an amazing vehicle to help make disciples for Jesus Christ.
A life disciple is someone who is willing to work with women and men as they are facing a pregnancy decision.
As a life disciple, we have the honor and the privilege and the blessing of walking with people in the middle of their crisis.
When I was pregnant at 17, I went to our local OBGYN, and he asked me, is this good news or is this bad news? And I said, this is not good news. And he said, well, here's the number for an abortion clinic in New York City. And that was really the extent of the counseling that I had or the care. You know, it was like, if this is an unplanned pregnancy, abortion is the solution. And if I had a life disciple at 17, I would have chosen life instead of abortion.
What conquers fear is love. And when you envelop this lady with love, and encouragement and compassion, that I want to cry with you, I want to laugh with you, I want to embrace you, I want to love you. You've opened up the door to share the gospel. So the Bible is clear that God has authored life, he sustains life, and his goal is that we might have abundant life that Jesus Christ offers. And of course, the church is the best place to offer all of it.
I firmly believe the more educated people are about the abortion issue, the more and more people become pro-life and want to protect unborn children and women and men from the destruction of abortion. So that's really to the core of how we solve the abortion issue in our country, is to reach the people that it's impacting the most.
Our goal with this curriculum is for people who will be trained as life disciples and will have an opportunity to meet with people who are facing a pregnancy decision. I mean, people who have before them life or death. Our hope and our prayer is that you will help them choose life. Great. pretty neat stuff. Now, I don't have time to go into all the aspects of making life disciples. We actually have created a detailed question and answer video, which we'll show some during the conference just a little bit, but then also there's a longer version, which you'll be able to get on the CareNet affiliate internal website, so if you need that. But I do want to stress a couple of points. The first one being is that this is not a pregnancy center in a church. This is a pregnancy care ministry within a church, which would be similar to the kinds of ministries like Celebrate Recovery. Some of you may be familiar with that, which was designed really for folks who are facing, you know, alcohol, sexual addiction issues, and having a ministry on-ramp in the church for that, to address the kinds of things that I already mentioned before that are happening in the church. This also puts a trained person in the church as a contact for the pregnancy center that's trained, that has a passion for this issue, and they're trained to receive folks from outside of the church in a very powerful way, and being trained, used a lot of the training that we've developed over the years. And I really believe in a very powerful way that this is going to enhance pregnancy centers' connection and reach in the church and raise awareness to the life issue in the church, and not just on Sanctity of Life Sunday. Because there will be someone living and breathing and walking and talking about this issue in the church on a constant basis. You know, and the other thing, you know, as you kind of think about this, you know, I love telling folks that life decisions need life support. And sort of the analogy I use is sort of this kind of speedboat, this amazing work that pregnancy centers can do, and the kind of support that pregnancy centers provide. But you've got to have an ability to move people from your speedboat to the SS Compassion. Otherwise, you might end up just putting them back in the water and rescuing them again. And when you think about the reasons why women and men choose abortion, those issues are kind of addressed in the life rings that are supported by both the pregnancy centers and the church. So we're really uniquely positioned in an amazing way to do that. And that's why I'm so excited about the opportunity that's before us. You know, we have an amazing opportunity to build an integrated service delivery platform. I'm a business guy, so that's how I talk. But in ministry speak, wells of compassion. Wells of compassion, right? So that we can meet a client at their point of need. So as you can see from the slide on the left-hand side, there are the client's needs and wants. And our goal is to reach clients however they need and want to be reached. So if they seek anonymity and never want to darken the door of a pregnancy center, well, there's the pregnancy decision line with trained coaches who will share the gospel and help these women come to a life decision as well and connect them to a pregnancy center as well. But if they need high touch, face-to-face care, evangelism, pregnancy tests, ultrasound, material support, well, then the pregnancy centers are there for that amazing, amazing work. But if they need long-term support and discipleship, which anyone who becomes a convert to Jesus Christ needs, then churches and the members are going to be trained to do this as well. And once you see some of the new stuff that we're doing, for example, the Before You Decide tablet app, which is available on both the Apple and the Android platform, you'll actually be able to go anywhere. You're going to see a big demonstration of that on stage here later on in the conference. You'll be able to go anywhere. You'll meet her at a Starbucks, meet her at a home, meet wherever. See, in many ways, you know, we've been fighting a person with one arm tied behind their back. I mean, one arm cut off with one arm tied behind our back just to make it fair. The reality is that we've got an ability to go everywhere because our secret sauce is you. Abortion machines aren't portable. People are. People can move. And when the gates of hell, see, the gates of hell don't move. Gates don't move. That's why we have the full armor of God. Not on our back, so don't stab me. But we should be advancing, climbing over, shaking, going around, digging under, shaking the gates of hell. So we want to mobilize not just you, but everybody to be a life advocate for this amazing work. And, you know, that's truly what it means to be pro-abundant life. You're not just focused on saving babies, as God honors that He is, but you also want to address and focus on why these babies are at risk to begin with and the support that they need, consistent with God's design, to make sure that those babies do not become clients and that their mothers and fathers don't become repeat clients. Why? Because they've been transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ and empowered to choose life for their unborn children, an abundant life for their families. They've become disciples for life who make disciples for life. Amen. Again, thank you so much for being here. Have a blessed and wonderful conference. And I was supposed to say you're dismissed. You're dismissed. Thank you very much.